Now, what's the problem of the Highland Indians and the lowland ethnic enclaves? The problem is revolution. The problem is war and civil strife. At the current time throughout South America, throughout Central America, unlike the Andean region and unlike the lowland South American countries, they're in the midst of violent revolutions. Revolutions in the name, really, of agrarian reform and of rural and national social transformation, but that are carrying out with weapons of war, that are part of the East-West struggle, the Soviet Union and Cuba and the United States, that are part of models of society that will impose radical transformations on the Central American countries, or will continue with repressive apparatuses, for example in Guatemala, to maintain much systems of control where there will be no parliamentary democracy, very little public participation. And it's that conflict, that uprooting, that turmoil, where indigenous people have been right in the middle of it. The case of Guatemala is perhaps the most serious, because in Guatemala, in the struggle between revolutionary movements and between the Guatemalan military, perhaps as many as 1 million people have been uprooted in Guatemala. 1 million indigenous people of a population of 4 million are displaced. At least 150,000 are in Mexico, 46,000 in camps, either along the Chiapas border with Chiapas or in Campeche at present. 900,000 Indians in Guatemala have been organized by the Guatemalan military into civilian defense patrols without any voluntary choice. The government is planning to build 75 strategic hamlets, which they call model villages. Indigenous communities have been massacred in the scores. Thousands of indigenous people have disappeared, and their families don't know where they are. It's a situation in the Americas that could only be compared from the indigenous point of view to Cambodia. From the indigenous point of view. On the national level, it hasn't quite reached Cambodia, but on the indigenous level, it's comparable to the genocide that has taken place. And on the other side, we have Nicaragua, where as a result of an armed struggle and an armed revolution and a social transformation in a new regime that was both nationalist and also socialist and Marxist in its orientation, an enormous conflict emerged between the ethnic rights of an ethnic federation, Misurasata, that developed after the Sandinista Revolution, and the Sandinista state, a conflict which led to the suppression of the indigenous organization, Misurasata, the jailing of its leadership in February of 1981, the escape of in the spring of February 81 of at least 3,000 Miskito to Honduras, the continued suppression of the indigenous organization in the summer of 1981, and armed conflict between indigenous people in both Honduras and within Nicaragua with the Sandinista Revolutionary Government from 1982 onward. In January of 1982, 8,500 Miskito from over 40 villages along the Rio Coco were relocated without any choice to an area outside of the border with Honduras, and another 12,000 Miskito went into Honduras as refugees. Currently, there's over 20,000 Miskito as refugees on the Honduran side of the border, numerous people living in relocation camps within Nicaragua, and an incredible degree of animosity that sometimes has moved toward some levels of negotiation between the state and the indigenous people, but then periodically there'll be an attempt at reconciliation and then a failure. Well, from the Alaska point of view, what's the relationship to the armed, the role of violence in relationship to the indigenous people? These will be my final comments. In that situation, I don't think there are some parallels if we want to move toward, in terms of indigenous land rights and cultural rights, the right to autonomy, but I think the major lesson from that situation is the potentiality of Native peoples that are outside of Central America to provide solidarity in terms of protecting and defending the human rights of the indigenous populations of Central America. The main, perhaps, relationship here, I think lesson to be learned, is the necessity at this point for an alliance between indigenous people with the indigenous people of Central America. The voice of indigenous people, the degree of human rights violation, is not known by the United States Congress. It's known, but it's not currently having much influence. There's a military and economic aid package of $68 million to the Guatemalan government at present, most of which is being allocated for projects in the Guatemalan highlands. The United States is providing the weapons of war in the Honduran, in the Nicaraguan conflict between the insurgents that are outside of Nicaragua and the Sandinista government, the weapons of war that are making it impossible for reconciliation between, in part impossible for reconciliation between the Nicaraguan government and the Miskito people in exile. And perhaps the influence that could be brought to make this a moral issue and eventually a political issue is by Native people joining in support of their brothers and sisters in Central America. The thing that essentially comes to mind is the role, for example, of Israel and the role that the American Jewish community has played in relation to Israel, or the role that the American Irish community has placed in relation to Ireland, or the role that the American Polish community has played in terms of United States policy toward Eastern Europe. The indigenous Native American people have not yet had a voice in North America in terms of foreign policy, and perhaps the issues around Central America, if brought by indigenous Native people, could have an influence on U.S. foreign policy that could then have consequences in Central America for the rights of those people. Well, I sort of, just to summarize, given three situations that are incredibly complex, but perhaps, you know, or some level of discussion and
well, thanks, Sandy. Just before we put questions to Sandy, let me welcome Oscar Coagley to the roundtable. Oscar Coagley is a member of the Executive Council of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and Director of Native Education in the Lower Kuskokwim School District here in Alaska. So we're glad you were able to make it, Oscar. Well, anybody want to question Sandy about some of these things that he's talked about?
My name is Bernard Nitschman.
Yes, welcome. I didn't realize you'd arrive. Wait for your name card.
Thank you. It's hard to read these names from the back. Yeah, with my name, it doesn't matter. It's just long, it's mine. I found your presentation very interesting and thought that you gave a very good analysis of some of the comparisons between Guatemala and Nicaragua. I might point out that, however, the Indian resistance forces in in Nicaragua and those based in Honduras and southeastern Nicaragua, Costa Rican border, no longer get weapons from the U.S. and haven't since April of last year. So they're pretty much on their own. And they have been abandoned by the U.S. because they have definite Indian interests and not the overthrow of the Sandinista state, but the regaining of their Indian lands. So although the weapons of war make it impossible for reconciliation in any event, no weapons are made in Nicaragua and they're all imported regardless of the side.
Just while we're while you're on that subject, Mr. Nietzschman, we discussed this morning the fact that throughout the world, indigenous people seek self-determination. In the United States, that expression it is known as limited sovereignty, and they seek as well a land base. What is it that the Miskito Indians seek in terms of their relations with the Nicaraguan state? What are their ambitions in terms of self-determination and land? Are you able to comment on that?
Certainly. They really would like is an accord, and I think Sandy Davis brought up the important example of the San Blas Cuna of the Caribbean coast of Panama, who have an area that has a great degree of autonomy. It's the Comarca de San Blas. That would be the equivalent of a state in the United States sense of it. And they have a great degree of control over their affairs. They have a certain accord with the Panamanian government based on, as Professor Davis said, with various amendments, constitutional amendments, the Carta Orgánica, and so on. The Miskito have looked at this very closely and, in fact, have brought it up at the first peace treaty negotiations in Bogota between the indigenous resistance leaders and the Sandinista comandantes, Luis Carrion. And they used it as a prime example, because what is happening is the need to forge, literally, to create new examples. And the Miskito want, and Sumun Rama want, not to withdraw from the state of Nicaragua, but to have an accord whereby internally they have local autonomy. And they wish to have control over their lands, their resources, and self-determination. Self-determination meaning as self-identified peoples with common territory, not to simply want to maintain the past, sort of traditional culture frozen in time. They're not fighting to preserve their culture. They're really fighting to gain control over their lives and to ensure control over their land. And what we're talking about here is land and resources. That's the critical thing that all of Eastern Nicaragua, Indian Nicaragua, comes down to. And every issue and every question will pertain to land. And that's where it is right now. As a result of Bogota meetings in 84, at the end of 84, December, the government of the Sandinista state set up a commission on autonomy to study the land situation. The Indians set up their own commission, and at Montevideo, in the inauguration of the new government there, while Schultz was talking to Ortega, Ortega was talking to the president of Colombia, Betancourt, and gave him the green light for the second go-ahead. Betancourt met with Brooklyn Rivera secretly this weekend in San Andres, an island in the Western Caribbean. Misurasata gave the go-ahead. And March 23rd and 24th, there'll be a second go-around of these peace negotiation talks between the Indian resistance and the Sandinista government, again in Bogota. And the issue will be over land. So to answer your question, it's land. Land in waters and offshore waters, too. The Indians, as Sandy Davis mentioned, are marine fishermen and hunters, and they include that as part of their territory. And they want control over it as a people. And that, I see, unites a lot of movements in the world, from the Naga, Karing, Papuan movement, OPM in West Papua, Kalinga in North Central Luzon, Kanak movement in New Caledonia. These people all have arms. And they're determined. They're determined to try to achieve self-determination. And that means land.
Yeah. Orrin Young and then Bishop DeRue.
I was really intrigued with the description Sandy Davis gave about the South and Central American situations, but I have a question which is perhaps a very general question, by which I hope would maybe get at his view of what some of the sort of critical causal factors are in the situations that he described. And it goes something like this. Suppose that a commission were created for one or another of the three situations that you told us about. Let's say the Amazon Basin situation or any of the other two. And this commission was a native review commission, perhaps much like the one that we're attending here. And suppose that you were somehow or other named to be the commissioner for the Amazon Basin Native Review Commission, and you even further accepted the position. This may make it an extreme hypothetical question, but imagine that you were in that sort of situation. Looking at it from your present circumstances, and of course you haven't thought of it probably from this point of view, nonetheless, what sort of tack do you imagine that you might take? What kinds of levers do you think are really the critical levers that might somehow or other help to protect the interests of these communities? Would this be an acknowledgement of rights, and would that be sufficient, or would you have to do something about some of these other sort of social and economic forces that Robert Goldman, for example, was talking about before lunch, that may overrun even apparent guarantees of rights? Obviously, this is a large issue, but I'm just sort of curious as to, you know, your preliminary response to a problem posed that way.
Well, just first of all, I would never take on the assignment. I could understand why a Canadian would take on an assignment of coming to Alaska, but a gringo going to the Amazon Basin to run a review commission would cause such an enormous uproar that I would probably go with 10 bodyguards next to me. And I would never take on, I mean, there's a history there of relationship of the Latin American nation states to the United States that one has to take into consideration. Some of the Central American republics were called banana republics for a very real reason. The United Fruit Company was very powerful in some of those, or other corporations were very powerful, and the U.S. government has played the Monroe Doctrine has been there, and there's been a question about, in fact, in Venezuela, in the Venezuelan press this summer, there was large discussions that the whole movement in defense of indigenous rights is being generated from Europe and the United States, and is really an attempt to get a hold of the resources of the Amazon Basin. So the hypothetical thing isn't even politically realistic. If there was a commission, what I would suggest, there's no doubt that there's larger issues that have to deal with the national social structure of these countries, about the role of the state vis-a-vis indigenous communities, about the in the juridic system, like Barney Nietzschman has pointed out in terms of indigenous land rights, if one looks at all the legislation that was created, and the reason why it was created in the 1960s and the 1970s is because of Convention 107 of the International Labor Organization, which is the only current international convention that deals with indigenous rights. That is the reason why Brazil, Paraguay, Colombia, Peru, and several other countries have created specific legislation dealing with indigenous rights, although there is some history there, but their legislation is modeled after Convention 107. And there has to be a very serious discussion of about the position of the indigenous people vis-a-vis resources, vis-a-vis political autonomy. So there would have to be people there that could discuss the juridic element. The most important thing, though, as it is here, is how to get the participation of indigenous people in the process of policy and decision making. That poses fundamental problems, as Nicaragua shows, in terms of when indigenous people want to participate, they're suppressed. They're suppressed by the state security apparatus. The Minister of Interior in every country, as it was, I believe, in the United States, perhaps up until when did the interior begin, 1840, until perhaps the FBI was created and the Justice Department was also the Minister of State Security. And in all Latin American countries, all South and Central American countries at present, the Minister of the Interior is the head of state security, including Tomas Borges. There's no doubt about it. So any indigenous person in many countries, there are exceptions, that wants to participate in the political process, especially with an organization like a federation, faces the possibility of being losing one's rights, of being tortured, of being suppressed, of being forced into exile. It's different than a parliamentary democracy. That's where I think having some international framework of support and solidarity is so important, because in order to participate in those discussions, it'll be international public opinion. That's the most important, how to get these new organizational structures such that there's an open enough political environment that they could participate. I take it that's what the whole Misura Santa Sandinista discussion now is about. For example, it would be impossible right now to hold those discussions inside Nicaragua, probably. Maybe after two or three sessions in Bogota, those discussions could be held in Nicaragua, but the security of Brooklyn Rivera, you know, if he went back, would be in jeopardy. It would be impossible right now in Guatemala. There's no civil order in Guatemala at present. There's a constituent assembly that is relatively powerless, but there is no civil order, a society that the Maya could have their point of view represented in the constituent assembly on any level of policy. So that's the problem. The problem is some fundamental rights. I would say take a close look at the American Convention on Human Rights, the American Declaration on Human Rights. Because, I mean, they're very specific documents if there was the juridic minds that could look at those documents, they could have an enormous impact. And the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights has taken a close look through the American Convention on Human Rights at the suppression of the human rights and other rights of the indigenous population of Nicaragua. So, I don't know. We're at a very different level. The technical and intricate issues that are being discussed by the convention, by the commission here, can have an impact someday. But we're at a first order of business first in some of these countries. We're
survival. I mean, that is survival against weaponry that may be directed at you from any number of factions. Bishop DeRue.
I'll try to be brief and just touch on four little points. First of all, on the basis of my own personal experience in Central and South America, I'd like to express my admiration for that magnificent summary that Sandy gave us, and support what Bernard added also. It's absolutely true. One little detail with regard to Panama, you also have a highlands situation there, which I was able to visit a few years ago, which is worth bringing into focus because it touches on the international ramifications. You know, a similar problem occurred in the Chiriquí area, the Guaymi natives of western Panama up in the highlands, who were being invaded by a huge copper project in the Cerro Colorado. And that was backed by Canadian and American investments, and it later shifted to Rio Tinto Zinc of Britain. And there were high-level negotiations there involving the Panamanian government itself, and the Roman Catholic bishops took a position for the Guaymi natives against the development of Cerro Colorado, not only on the basis that it was a highly risky business for the Panamanian government because the substructures that the Panamanian government would have put in there would have been more expensive than their entire national budget at a time when the copper market was very soft, but because it would literally have wiped out those Guaymi people who were in a very different cultural position from ours. Shortly before we were there, they had just recently discovered the use of horses, and they had never seen a machine before. When the first bulldozer made its tracks through the mountains, they did not dare walk on the road made by the bulldozers because of fear that, you know, this had something to do with a new supernatural power. So a totally different world, but absolutely delightful people whom we had an opportunity to visit, living in tiny little communities, very, very fragile social structure, but also in an exquisite balance with that frail ecology. So just to complete that, but also because that's where we touch the international implications of a problem affecting just the tiny little people up in the Cerro Colorado highlands. And I wanted to support completely what Bernard was saying about it is indeed a question of survival, a question of land, a question of resources, a question of the very culture that makes the, you know, the cultural identification of these peoples. And I'm using culture here not in the academic sense of the variety of cultures, but in the deeper sense of human self-identity. You know, we are, why we do things the way we do them, the way we are, which is fundamentally our culture, our self-understanding, and will be ultimately the reason whether peoples will survive or not. If peoples lose their cultural identity, they will disappear. If they maintain their cultural identity, no amount of external pressure or invasion will destroy them. And I think that's a vast question that maybe is not directly pertinent to the topic here, but there's a question there of which cultures will ultimately survive, our recent Western culture or the native cultures that have predated us by centuries. There's a huge issue there. But the third point, very briefly, is that the peasant peoples of Latin America that some of us may have referred to as illiterate and so forth, have a very sophisticated sense of history, and especially now an emerging sense of international relationships and interdependence. Let me give you a little example. I was in the tiny little village of San Juan del Sur in Nicaragua one evening, chatting with refugees from Guatemala and from the areas around there, including Salvador, discovered in their discussion of the revolution in Salvador that for them the boundaries, the geographical divisions that white people had traced between Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua simply didn't exist. They just moved back and forth and had practiced the amazing acts of solidarity, of feeding one another in the revolution. And they were referring to it as our revolution. And their reflection, which is very pertinent here, their reflection about the Sandinista government was the following. Isn't it marvelous how the Sandinista have understood our cause and are on the side of our revolution? But the implication was very clear that the moment the Sandinista government would betray the natives' revolution, they would find another government. And that's very significant in Nicaragua, because it is basically the peasants of Nicaragua who fought the revolution. So I just wanted to emphasize the point that we're not talking ideology here. And I'm really saddened here in North America to see how we have overlaid this fundamental issue with this supposed East-West ideological conflict that has nothing to do with the topic and totally distorts our understanding of what's going on in Latin America. Because basically, it is the awakening of hundreds of millions of native peoples becoming conscious of what history has done to them and coming to a point now where they say, this has to stop. Enough is enough. And through a variety of revolutions, bloody or otherwise, they are moving forward. And as one very good observer in Mexico who had been in Latin America for a long time told me, he says, look, the peasants of the world are very wise people. They know that up until now, every revolution has been fought in their blood and has not benefited them. So they're not about to be the first to step forward and get their faces pushed in or smashed. But he said there is an emerging resolve on their part, and when they finally decide to take one step forward, they will never step back. So in that context, I think it's extremely important to be sensitive to what is happening here. We're not talking just about a local issue. We are talking about international questions. And I would agree totally that the best thing that we can possibly do, not only for the local situation here, not only for the native peoples in a particular area, but for humanity as a whole in terms of future peace, is to support internationally all the efforts by the native peoples to reach out to one another and to gradually, as one of them said, get their place in the sun. And that's going to mean major shifts in our Western political and economic systems. But it has to come. And my hope is that it can be done peacefully, because otherwise we're going to be into worldwide conflict.
Thank you, Bishop Derulo. Sheldon Kachetag.
Thank you. First of all, one of the things that really worries me about this is, in looking over the roundtable description, it asks questions. Do Native Americans have valid claims to institutions of their own? You know, if you have to ask that question, good grief, we're that far. That means that you have to ask these questions if we do have a valid place. We want our culture to be a living culture. That's what we're fighting for. We don't want to be an artifact culture. Earlier, Mr. Goldwyn was talking about the principles of dealing with Native people, principles of dealing with Indians. And he also made the statement about, well, Las Casas was making all these making the case for human rights of the indigenous peoples of the Americas, that at the same time, the conquistadors were wiping them out. At the same time that Madison was making all these great speeches about the equality of Indians to the non-Indians, that the Indian wars were wiping them out. That's a thing that we've been facing as Indians, Native people, Indigenous people. On the one hand, they pay us lip service and say, yes, you do have all your rights. Yes, we are safeguarding your property. But what are they doing on the other hand? They're passing laws that says, you will comply with my laws if you want to live. Even though you have been living in your culture, in your traditions, off your land, since time immemorial. Now you have to obey these laws to do the very same things. And you will do it when we say the season is open, you will do it when we say you have a license, you will do it when we say you have a permit. And you will only harvest as much as our law says. It really scares me that even as we sit here, that our people here in the state are facing the very same kind of human rights violations that you hear about in Central and South America. But we don't hear about these things. I just found out today about an incident where there were 5 or 6 state troopers and fish and wildlife people that stormed a village. Stormed a village with loaded guns here in Alaska. What is going on here? We have been asked time and time again, look at what Christ said. The Bible, Christianity, to my way of thinking, is the ideal as far as interpersonal, intercultural relationships. And in looking at the Bible, it outlines the ideal and the proper way in which you relate to your fellow society members. But the thing that we're not facing here is that the religion, the Christianity that says you must believe in these high ideals, that you must turn the other cheek, only apply to us. Why do we have to turn our cheek every time? We believe in your religion. We felt that if, in fact, this is what you believe in, and that is what your preachers have been preaching us for the last 200 years, that these are the highest ideals. This is how you relate to your fellow man. But their actions are opposite. And that's what scares me. We have to abide by your religion. We have to abide by these principles that say you must treat your fellow man fairly. You must act in good faith. And yet every time we turn around, our good faith is betrayed. Why did we even have a Claim Settlement Act? Because we trusted the federal government. They said, everything that you have is protected. Don't worry about it. Trust us. In 1959, they laid the state of Alaska on us. And if that wasn't bad enough, in 1971, they said, everything that you trusted us to hold in trust for you, you now have to claim, but don't expect more than 10%. Is that fair? Lip service. That's how they justify everything. They say, lip service. We're saying all these things. Look at us, we're good people. We believe in human rights. But what we're practicing is genocide. The native people of the Americas are the same people. Variations in language, variations in customs, but we're basically the same people. And we're all being oppressed pretty much by the same government. You look at the World Almanac and see who controls each and every individual country. And it really appalls me to see the federal, an almanac like we see come out every year that lists countries, and in the description it says Coca-Cola owns this country, or the United Brands Fruit Company owns this country, or some other multinational owns this country. And it doesn't bother the people of America, United States of America. It doesn't bother them. Oh, I've got shares in that. Never mind that they are oppressing these people that have all these valid existing rights that people talk about. And yet, regularly on a day-to-day basis, these rights are being violated. Right versus might, good versus bad. The Bible, we would be happy, I think, or close to it, if the people that brought us the Bible and Christianity would in fact practice what they preach. We're practicing what you preach, and we're getting burned at every turn. We're asked to turn the other cheek, and all we get is another slap on the other cheek. How long will our people stand for this? We've got to get back to our relationship with the federal government, the special government-to-government relationship they were so want to bring and say that we had before 1959. Alaska's natives, you have a special government-to-government relationship with the federal government. Trust us. People always ask, when we talk about UTA, why are you getting your dander up about ANCSA now? Why are you waiting so long? If you feel so strongly about this, why didn't you do something about it in 1971? If you had your lives so totally disrupted that you didn't know up from right, down from left, or even know that you got your direction mixed up, how are you supposed to respond to something like that within 1 or 2 years? And Congress put a rider on ANCSA that says, if anyone has any legal claims that run counter to this act, you have 1 year in which to bring that action. After a year, stop it. you're going to have to live with it. It's this kind of thing that we have to do something about, and we have to do it together. We have to get together and negotiate this thing. The Native people of Alaska are living in a gray area. They don't know if they should stand behind their tribal government, that government which has brought them through thousands of years. Or do they go with the municipality, in effect for the last 15 years in most cases? Do you trust the federal government anymore? I don't want to, but I have to. They are securing my physical security, I hope. And I would hope that among the recommendations that would come out of this round table and all the rest of the testimony, that we would see a recommendation, not only for recognition of our tribal governments and our jurisdiction, but also a call for negotiation. I extended this call at AFM's convention in October. I have yet to hear from anybody in either the state or the federal government. And yet I got a standing ovation from my people. They were behind me on this. They want to see this issue resolved. I'm tired of living like this. Ellen Hayes made the point to me in talking about being Native. Being Native is a stressful life. God, it's hard sometimes. Every time we turn around, there's another assault on our being Native. And I think that we should bear this in mind as we go through these next 4 days, that this being the last round table, we are going to have to come up with some very concrete recommendations, things that we all can live with. Because I don't want to see the situation in Alaska deteriorate to the situation that they're talking about in Nicaragua or any of those Central or South American countries. I'm not saying that it will, but I sure would hate to see it do that. Because this is a huge state. There's more than enough to go around. You don't have to take it all. It didn't belong to you in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheldon. I have Rosita Worrell and Archie and Verna Kirkness, but I thought that we should take a break for a cup of coffee and to stretch our legs, and then we'll recommence. Let's take a 5-minute break.
I'm glad I got here when I did. It's really great to hear and take a lot of tips here. It's true.